the agreement, the 25-year agreement, and we have a comprehensive approach towards it. In this atmosphere of cooperation, we did not expect the 2014 agreement regarding the three islands that are, and we did not expect that agreement to be repeated, and we have voiced our dissatisfaction through diplomatic channels, and we have sent a formal note to the Chinese side, because these islands are an historical part of Iran, an inseparable part of Iran. So we do emphasize continuation of strategic cooperation with China, and we openly said that we are determined to continue to protect our territorial integrity. The relevant Chinese officials, in a meeting with our president and our vice president, and also in the meeting between our ambassador and the Chinese officials, the Chinese side has actually rectified that mistake, and I thank them for that. In conclusion, I wish to emphasize that Iraq plays a crucial role in West Asia. The geopolitical and geostrategic position of Iraq has brought about a capacity for that brotherly and friendly country in our neighborhood that in such a way that regional cooperation and Iraq's efforts for enhancement of all-out cooperation at the regional level, and that is feasible today by benefiting from Iraq's capacity, that's been the agenda of the region. Tomorrow, the leaders and foreign ministers of regional states within the framework of Baghdad 2 summit will gather in Hashemite, Jordan, and they will come together, and this means that Iraq, by going through many crises today, it is in a position that has actually returned to its natural and regional position. In conclusion, I would like to once again thank distinguished guests and participants for attending this gathering, and I'm certain that today's dialogue within the technical panels will be constructive. Thank you for your kind attention. I would like to thank Dr. Amir Abdullahian, the foreign minister, for his valuable remarks. At the end of the opening ceremony of the Third Tehran Dialogue Forum, allow me to once again thank all the esteemed guests and participants. I would like to thank all the ambassadors and all the scholars who have attended this gathering, and also representatives of major Iranian think tanks, the university lecturers and researchers, and also my colleagues at the foreign ministry. And I would like to thank them all.
Right, this is Tehran, the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You just listened to a live coverage of the Third Tehran Dialogue Forum. sponsored by the Institute for Political and International Studies of the Iranian Foreign Ministry here in Tehran. You just heard Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian make a keynote speech at the Tehran Dialogue Forum. Amir Abdollahian, the Iranian Foreign Minister, said Iran admonishes the United States for using Afghanistan soil to launch terrorist attacks against regional countries when the U.S. was occupying Afghanistan. He also said Iran warns the West against attempts to destabilize Iran and against misusing Iran's internal issues to launch a hybrid war against Tehran. He also said, Amir Abdollahian also referred to JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. He urged the United States once again to return to this key nuclear accord. And in further comments, Abdollahian also said that Iran expects China not to endorse or go along with claims made by Persian Gulf Arab countries regarding the three Iranian islands in the Persian Gulf. He said the three islands are an integral and inseparable part of Iranian territory. And Amir Abdollahian said in contacts made between senior Iranian and Chinese officials, Iran has made clear to Beijing that Iran does not, under any circumstances, enter into any sort of negotiations with regards to its own territorial integrity. And he said that we made this point very clear to the Chinese officials. We don't expect China to endorse or go along with claims made by Persian Gulf Arab countries regarding the three Iranian islands. Now, the forum is essentially, this is the third year that the forum has been held, the Tehran Dialogue Forum. Its aim is to promote peace, friendship, and trust building. This is the principal aim of the forum, to build, encourage peace, friendship, and trust building. We heard Adel Abdul Mahdi, the former Iraqi prime minister, make a keynote speech. We heard Hossein Amir Abdollahian, the Iranian foreign minister. We also heard the deputy Venezuelan prime minister of Venezuela. And we also heard the Nicaraguan ambassador to Tehran make speeches at the forum. This has been a live coverage of the Tehran Dialogue Forum. We now return to our regular programming.
Headlines: Iran dismisses recent claims by the CIA director on Tehran-Moscow cooperation, saying they are part of Washington's propaganda war against Tehran. The UK declares a new military aid package for Ukraine that includes precision-guided missiles, despite Russia's warnings that Western arms only prolong the war. And several French cities witness clashes between police and football fans following France's defeat in the dramatic World Cup final against Argentina. Welcome. Our top story: Tehran has dismissed as unfounded claims by the head of the U.S. spy agency regarding Iran-Russia cooperation over the Ukraine war. The Iranian Foreign Ministry, that is spokesman Nasser Kanani, said baseless accusations leveled against Iran by the CIA over the Ukraine conflict are part of Washington's propaganda campaign against Iran. He said as part of their groundless political claims and illegal moves, U.S. authorities question conventional Iran-Russian defense and military cooperation. The spokesman noted this PR exercise by the White House is based on lies and deception and comes with different aims, namely exerting political pressure on Iran, provoking Iranophobia, and covering up Washington's warmongering Kanani reiterated Tehran-Moscow cooperation on different fronts, including in the defense domain, is in line with the two nations' common interests. He said the two sides are expanding their cooperation in compliance with their rights and international commitments. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi, meanwhile, has denounced the West, the U.S. in particular, for using the human rights issue as a tool against independent nations. Raisi made the remark while meeting with visiting Nicaraguan Foreign Minister Denis Moncada. He said the U.S. has failed in its calculations to hatch new plots against sovereign countries. The Iranian president highlighted the expansion of ties between countries with convergent policies as one of the ways to thwart pressures exerted by arrogant powers. The Nicaraguan foreign minister, for his part, pointed to Iran's successful resistance against U.S. sanctions and pressure. Moncada also called for the expansion of trade and economic cooperation between Tehran and Managua. Afghans are calling for an independent and transparent investigation into dozens of summary killings by the UK Special Air Service troops in Afghanistan after years of reports that elite British forces have been killing civilians in cold blood. Rahmatullah Baghban reports from Kabul.
Afghan people have been calling for transparent and impartial investigations into crimes and wrongdoings by NATO forces on their soil. Among them, relatives of victims of the NATO war in southern Helmand province are demanding justice for the killing of 54 unarmed people by British Special Air Service troops there. The dead include children. Afghans want the murderers should be held accountable.
Helmand province witnessed deadly night raids and airstrikes by NATO forces, especially those of the UK. Besides, civilian captives were tortured and shot dead. In one case, children were thrown off military planes. I remember so many atrocities by the foreign forces in which civilians were harmed. We call for those British and American perpetrators to be tried in an impartial and transparent court. They should be brought to account and victims should receive compensation.
However, the UK government has announced the start of an inquiry into wrongdoings by its forces in Afghanistan, but some experts say only transparent probes by independent bodies can help make headway with the case. They believe investigations by foreign governments could cover up the facts about the gross violations at the hands of their forces in Afghanistan. During the two-decade US invasion, Afghanistan witnessed much disgrace by NATO troops. More and more facts are emerging regarding unlawful killings and gross violations by foreign forces on Afghan soil. The U.S. war on Afghanistan has left many Afghans in great suffering. People here are calling for accountability and justice for years of gross violation by the NATO troops. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Palestinians have come under increasing settler attacks in the past couple of months. The settlers have drawn public anger by storming the Al-Aqsa Mosque and killing two Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. We have discussed the issue in our news review program.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has condemned the latest raid on Al-Aqsa Mosque by Israeli settlers. Hamas says such incursions are provocative and very dangerous. The movement has urged Palestinians to mobilize immediately in defense of Al-Aqsa Mosque. The resistance movement stressed that the Palestinian nation will make sure to protect the mosque under any circumstances, warning Israel of the consequences of raids on the holy site. In the meantime, an Israeli settler has killed two Palestinian brothers in the occupied West Bank. The settler ran over them while they were fixing a broken tire. He has fled the scene. There has been an increase in coordinated and armed settler attacks in Nablus in recent months. Mona Kandil is a correspondent joining us from occupied Ramallah. Sadin Nimr is a professor of political science at Birzeit University, also joining us from Ramallah. Welcome to you both. So Mona Kandil, it's the unfortunate death of these two brothers. Really, the pictures speak volumes. Tell us a little bit more about what happened there. And maybe it's a good time to ask you, if you can, Mona, since we're drawing this year on the Christian calendar to an end, as to why there has been such an uptick with the Palestinian lives being lost At this point, I think it's well over 240 Palestinians that have lost their lives since the beginning of the year.
Well, the story is that Palestinians were a group of Palestinians, or five brothers, were returning back from Nablus. They were checking preparations for the wedding of their sister, and they were returning back from Nablus to Ramallah. Near the Israeli military checkpoint of Za'atara, their vehicle broke down, so they exited the vehicle, and they were trying to fix one of the vehicle's tire. But an Israeli settler deliberately ran his car into them, killing two brothers, Muhammad and Muhannad Amtir, from the Kalandia refugee camp. The Israeli military and the Israeli regime tried to show that what happened is only an accident, but it's pretty sure that it was ramming his vehicle. The settler has deliberately rammed his vehicle, knowing at the end of the day that even if he killed any Palestinian, none of the Israeli settlers or the Israeli soldiers would be sued for their crimes. At the time, the Israeli military continued to commit and insist to commit more crimes against the Palestinians, killing not only Palestinian fighters and members of resistance groups, but the Israeli forces have killed since the beginning of the year children, women, elderly, unarmed Palestinians. People were killed in cold blood, and even human rights organizations have accused the Israeli soldiers for committing crimes and killing people in cold blood. This is what happened last night in Nablus.
Yeah, sad number. Many Palestinians have been killed in cold blood over the past year, especially. And my question to you is, this has occurred without the new administration really taking a hold of really ruling Israel, or Palestine, I should say. When we take a look at the very extreme, from what we understand, members that are going to be part of this, like the politician by the name of Ben-Gvir, are we looking at more, I guess, attacks on Palestinians, given that this year clocked in a record amount to have been killed?
Yes, that's exactly what we are expecting. This year, it was really a bloody year for the Palestinians, and the number of Palestinians who were killed and became martyrs by the Israeli troops and the settlers is really unexpected and not comparable with any other year since 2005 till now, according to the United Nations report. So it's quite obvious that the Israeli are now running more and more into this clashes with the Palestinians by firing at the Palestinians without even thinking and without even any cause for this kind of killing for the Palestinians. And that's quite clear what happened in Jenin just 2 weeks ago, killing three people, innocent people, normal people who were in the streets just in the morning, and it's not even resistance. It's quite clear what happened last night and last evening in Nablus. And it's going on and on. The children of being killed, like also a week ago, this girl child, she was killed on the roof of her town and on her house. It's quite clear that this government, anyway, is taking all these atrocities. Now we are expecting even more with two personalities added to the new government if Netanyahu declare it. Smotrich and Ben-Gvir. We are used to the atrocities by the Israelis because the whole country or whatever it is called, it's a colonialist, racist regime, and always they do that. But now we are expecting a little bit more than before. I'm not really surprised of what's coming on, because Israel is going more and more into this fascist regime, and even the Israelis themselves, they knew that it's going for fascist regime now, and there are lots of criticism to the new government. However, for us as Palestinians, we are going to continue our struggle, we are going to continue our resistance to this occupation. Regardless, we have seen more violence by the Israelis, and we've seen less, so we won't make a big difference between all these governments, because this is the policy of this racist colonialist state.
Thank you so much for that. Saad Nimr, professor of political science at Birzeit University. Mona Kandil, thank you so much, a correspondent there from occupied Ramallah. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Thanks for tuning in.
Now, the Iranian capital is hosting the third Tehran Dialogue Forum. This year's initiative is focused on the policy of the Islamic Republic toward its neighbors and its approach to friendship and trust building. The forum is attended by nearly 70 officials and representatives of think tanks and research centers from 36 countries. Our correspondent Gisu Misha Ahmadi is with us from the opening ceremony at the event. Let's bring in Gisu. Gisu, what more can you tell us about this year's gathering?
Well, Wassam, just as you mentioned so yourself, this is among one of the most important regional gatherings that is held annually in Iran, and it is dubbed a Tehran Dialogue Forum. This version is 2022, and like you mentioned so yourself, a number of high-ranking officials are here present in this a special forum that will be focusing on regional security. This is in line with President Ibrahim Raisi's policy to boost friendship and cooperation among regional countries. It has been his main focus ever since he took office, traveling to different regional countries and trying to boost cooperation, bilateral ties, and of course a special focus on regional security. We are expecting a keynote speaker, the foreign minister of Iran, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, to make a speech. And of course, we also have the former prime minister of Iraq and also the foreign minister of Nicaragua, who will be also delivering their speeches during the forum. Also, we are expecting a press conference later in the day with the foreign minister himself to give us more details about what exactly is going to happen, because as far as we know, based on the schedule that I have with me here, there will be five different panels to discuss different issues, including security in West Asia and the Persian Gulf, regional connectivity and energy security. Also, the Ukraine crisis will be one of the topics in these panels.
Great stuff, Gisu. Thank you very much. Now, moving on, the United Kingdom has confirmed delivery of another military aid package to Ukraine nearly 10 months into the Moscow-Kiev war. The British Ministry of Defense says the new package includes two precision-guided Brimstone missiles. The anti-tank weapons are capable of salvo attacks and autonomously finding targets once it reaches a designated target area. The ministry says the aid could play a crucial role in stalling Russian advances into the Ukraine territory. The new UK military aid comes as the West has already provided Kiev with billions of dollars worth of military aid to boost Ukraine's defense capabilities. Russia has warned time and again that a continued supply of Western weapons and equipment to Kiev will only prolong the war. Scenes of violence in the streets of France after the country's football team lost the FIFA's World Cup title. Clashes broke out in the capital, Paris, as well as in Lyon, among other cities. In Paris, scuffles erupted as police charged into the crowd to disperse bystanders. Also in Lyon, police used water cannons and tear gas to push back a mob which fought back, hurling projectiles at the officers. Officials say 15 people have been arrested. France were beaten by Argentina on penalties in the final match of the FIFA World Cup on Sunday. Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. The all-merciful, the all-compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willst, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
in the limelight.
Europe has been the scene of protests and strikes by the medical staff in the past few days. From the UK to Spain, the medical staff have been demanding higher pay. UK nurses have gone on a strike for the first time. National Health Service nurses say inadequate pay and staffing shortages put themselves and patients in danger. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Truth Out wrote, tens of thousands of nurses across the UK walked off the job in what's been described as the largest ever strike by National Health Service workers, who said they were forced to act after the government refused to negotiate over pay amid painfully high inflation. The walkout represents NHS nurses' first national strike, and it comes as UK rail and postal workers are also taking major labour actions in response to falling real pay, meagre benefits and worsening conditions. Nurses taking part in recent walkouts in England, Wales and Northern Ireland, one of two scheduled days of action in the week, lamented that a strike became necessary but said they had no choice as inadequate pay and staffing shortages put themselves and patients in danger. Healthcare workers also pointed to years of Tory-imposed funding cuts as a factor harming nurses and compromising the UK's public healthcare system. Nurses had enough. We are underpaid and undervalued, said nurse Lindsay Thompson of Northern Ireland, adding, yes, this is a pay dispute, but it's also very much about patient safety. The fact we cannot recruit enough nurses means patient safety is being put at risk. We have reached crisis point. We have been undervalued, underpaid, and underappreciated for the safety critical role we do, he said. Pat Collen, General Secretary and Chief Executive of the Royal College of Nursing, RCN, the union that represents NHS nurses, said in a statement recently that for many of us, this is our first time striking and our emotions are really mixed. The NHS is in crisis. The nursing profession can't take any more. Our loved ones are already suffering, said Collen, adding, it's not unreasonable to demand better. This is not something that can wait. The RCN said a strike became inevitable after UK ministers declined every offer to start formal pay negotiations. Earlier this week, Collen met with Tory Health Secretary Steve Barclay in a last-ditch effort to discuss pay before launching the national strike, but he refused to budge. I asked several times to discuss pay, and each time we returned to the same thing, that there was no extra money on the table and that they would not be discussing pay with me, Collen said, adding, I needed to come out of this meeting with something serious to show nursing staff why they should not strike. Regrettably, they're not getting an extra penny. Strike actions had also been planned in Scotland, the RCN noted, but they were put on hold after the Scottish government agreed to negotiate. According to the Health Foundation, an independent UK charity, nurses saw a 5% pay cut between 2011 and 2021 when accounting for inflation. Earlier this year, the UK government backed a 5 to 6% pay raise for most NHS nurses, but the RCN said that's far from enough, given the country's inflation rate of nearly 11%. RCN is demanding a 5% raise on top of inflation, which UK officials have rejected as too high. As a result of the strike and the next planned action on December 20th, parts of the NHS will be shut down, but urgent services will remain fully staffed. A recent survey found that nearly 60% of Britons support the nurses' decision to approve a strike. It is a tragic first for nursing, the RCN and NHS, Colin told The Guardian of the national walkout, adding nursing staff on picket lines is a sign of failure on the part of governments. Meanwhile, Euronews reported in Spain thousands of health personnel, including doctors working in emergency services, were on a strike in November. Besides a considerable increase in their wages, they requested more staff and more resources. In France, health workers joined protests in several cities in June with similar demands. Doctors in Germany went on a strike in March. In Turkey, health personnel went on a strike for better payment and work conditions in March. They also took to the streets in several Turkish cities in July to call for more action to prevent violence after a cardiologist was shot dead by a patient's relative. According to the Turkish Medical Association, thousands of Turkish doctors have left their post to work abroad over the past decade. They mostly prefer to move to Western countries, especially Germany. Health personnel, particularly hospital nurses, have worked ceaselessly during the COVID-19 pandemic. In many European countries, they are demanding better wages, improved working conditions, and more resources.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. As you know, on this program we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss how Britain, in the name of development aid, spawned corruption and injustice in Afghanistan for 20 years following the invasion. And we shall also look at growing tensions between regional rivals, India and China, fueled by the construction of dams on the Brahmaputra River.
A British government watchdog report says much of the £3.5 billion aid London provided to Afghanistan following the invasion of the country in 2001 was not spent on humanitarian aid, as claimed by the government officials, but on military operations, which in turn spawned rampant corruption and injustice. This mammoth funding served to advance the broader geostrategic and military agenda of the neo-imperial powers in the conflict-ridden South Asian country instead of humanitarian aid, relief or construction, with almost all international bodies aiding in the endeavour.
The Independent Commission for Aid Impact, a government body tasked with scrutiny of British development aid, in a report published last month, denounced the use of aid budget to fund the salaries of Afghan police and military as a questionable use of UK aid. The British government splurged £252 million on the salaries of Afghan National Police and £400 million on Afghan security services over the last 6 years of its operations in the country. Despite efforts by aid officials to stop the funding, the government overruled the move as it sought to prioritize the transatlantic alliance in line with its coalition ally, the United States. The report cited the British government documents that describe the situation as an extreme form of state capture, which benefited a narrow group of Afghan political elites at the expense of the population at large. The report added that in these circumstances, there was little prospect of meaningful institutional development in the war-ravaged country. The largest UK contribution of £668 million was to the World Bank program designed to fund basic services such as health and education, infrastructure investment, agriculture and jobs, but none of it managed to make any material difference to the lives of Afghan people.
Well, sure, they left it as in a greater mess than they had when they got there. So that of course is the responsibility of the force that had been there for 20 years. Somehow cannot just leave and say, well, you're on your own now. But there has been little indication the United States is prepared to do that. They thought that they could set up a satrap state under their direct control. That didn't quite work. So instead, now that it does have a government, which seems to be relatively in control, not entirely, but relatively in control, they would have the opportunity to try and assist to repair some of the damage that had been done by the 20-year devastation that was the occupation of Afghanistan by U.S. and British and NATO forces, in effect.
The hasty and ignominious drawdown of American and British troops from Afghanistan last August, after two decades of military occupation and horrendous war crimes, left the South Asian country on the brink of a monumental humanitarian catastrophe. For 20 years, foreign invaders exploited the country in the name of development and democracy. 20 years down the line, the country's economy is devastated, terrorism and insecurity are at their peak, and earthquakes and natural disasters have increased. All these problems have been compounded by the freezing of Afghan assets by the U.S. government.
Foreign powers invaded Afghanistan in 2001, ravaged its natural resources, destroyed the country, and abandoned it in complete ruins. According to the World Bank, the landlocked South Asian country is the sixth poorest in the world, with a gross national income per capita of only $500. The UN estimates that 24 million Afghans, or more than half of the population, today suffer from acute hunger. An estimated 8.7 million are at risk of famine, and 5 million children are on the brink of starvation. The situation has been complicated by the freezing of Afghan national assets by the U.S. government, the suspension of foreign aid, and a crippling economic blockade.
Well, obviously, the Afghan war was very controversial for American citizens. I mean, the number of deaths, American deaths there, the amount of treasure that was spent in the military operations in Afghanistan, essentially, you know, robbed a lot of people of not only their livelihoods, but also the lives of loved ones. This is the reason why the U.S. Really was forced to pull out because of this, the popular opposition to continued operations in Afghanistan. But they did it in such a way that they wanted to try and go and then put it behind them and pretend it didn't happen. Now, obviously, people are aware of the tremendous cost in terms of those who lost their loved ones. I mean, this can all easily be counted. But the overall costs of that war are still probably much greater than has been indicated. And therefore, if the truth really comes out, the reaction against those forces who were responsible for it would be so great that it could really overturn the apple cart in the political situation here in the United States.
The invasion of Afghanistan, which was led by the U.S. and the U.K., was in the first place based on a false premise. 20 years of war destroyed the country and produced one of the largest refugee populations in the world, despite tall claims of development by the foreign powers. After the hasty withdrawal last year, the British government vowed to give asylum to thousands of Afghans who worked with British forces. But more than a year later, they remain trapped in Afghanistan or neighboring Pakistan, which only underscores the devastating impact of 20-year military occupation in the name of building democracy and humanitarianism.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by Mr. Abdullah Khan from Islamabad. He's the Managing Director of Pakistan Institute for Conflict and Security Studies. Now, according to the British government watchdog, much of the aid the UK provided to Afghanistan between the year 2000 and 2020 served to entrench corruption and injustice in the country. Now, does that surprise you in any way?
Thank you very much for inviting me to your show. Actually, such revelation by the British watchdog does not surprise me because it is a well-known fact that much of the foreign aids and foreign money came into Afghanistan went to the corruption. That was the basic reason that despite all these efforts of 22 years, they could not build a nation, they could not build a state. All the state functionaries collapsed as soon as the Western forces withdrew from Afghanistan. So it was a well-known fact, and actually there is another fact that the Americans and their allies, particularly the Americans, they actually supported this corruption by their decision-making, and certain individuals were arrested in the Gulf, one of the Gulf states, the brother of one of very influential personality in Afghanistan were arrested. Briefly, then American intervened and he was released. So the corruption was not something which was not known to the Western powers. It was well known to them and it was well known to everybody. And you see all these people who were in power during this foreign occupation, where are they? They all have gone out of the country because there is no more money in the country to earn. So unfortunately, they came here for some other reasons, which I may let you know in my another reply. But there was the corruption was not a problem at all for the Western powers.
Now, Mr. Khan, instead of spending on humanitarian issues, the report says that billions of dollars worth of foreign aid was designed for broader geostrategic and military agendas in Afghanistan. Now, does that explain the basic aim of invading and occupying the country?
You know, from the fact that when 9/11 happened, after that, everybody knew that the then government of Taliban, although the world, they have a lot of problems with them, but none of the Taliban leader was involved in planning or executing, or even they didn't know about the 9/11. There was a strategic game which was planned and played in Afghanistan, on the soil of Afghanistan. Nation building or anything else was never an objective by the Western powers, unfortunately. And all that money came here was for some strategic designs. And eventually they failed because it is not possible for you to come invest in a country and try to change its values. The West came here and they tried to impose their version of democracy here, try to tell the people how to behave, how to, you know, do your daily lives, how to alter your values, which failed. Their prime objective was to use Afghanistan as a strategic chip against other countries in the region like China, Iran, Russia. And for 20 years they invested, and because their intention was not clear, their intention was nefarious, and that is perhaps the reason that they failed. they never came here for some positive design. So for these Western rich countries, such amount of money is perhaps nothing to lose if their strategic designs are served.
Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
London-based political activist Mervyn Hardwick says much of the UK's £3.5 billion aid to Afghanistan between 2000 and 2020 was spent as a cover for military domination. Patrick Wintour, Guardian diplomatic editor, cited an official review to note that the British aid to Afghanistan, largely directed by the US, only entrenched corruption and injustice. British barrister Jane Haybrook remarks that the speed with which the US and UK abandoned Afghanistan last year was to prepare for the next theater of war in Ukraine.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Amid China's plan to construct a super hydropower dam on the Brahmaputra, a transboundary river that flows through South Asia and represents a source of life for more than 130 million people in China, India and Bangladesh, Sino-India tensions have taken a new form and dimension. The Brahmaputra is deemed one of the basins most at risk for interstate water conflict. Although an all-out water war seems less probable, the strategic river continues to be intricately connected to tensions between India and China, complicating their long-lasting territorial dispute.
More than 2 years after China announced plans to build the 60-gigawatt super hydropower dam in Taiwan on the Brahmaputra River, close to the boundary with India, India is also mulling over constructing a 10-gigawatt dam to offset the impact of water flows from China's dam. The Chinese project, which was included in the country's five-year plan for 2021 to 2025, is poised to be the world's biggest dam that will come up in the foothills of the Himalayas. The Brahmaputra, which originates in the Qinghai-Tibet Plateau in southwest China, flows 2,900 kilometers across southern Tibet via the Himalayas before entering India. Each country in the region seeks to maximize its utilization, including India and China. The relations between China and India over shared water resources remain deeply complicated, with the Brahmaputra being essential to their socio-economic development. It accounts for nearly 30% of India's fresh water resources and 40% of its total hydropower potential. For China, the river's role in the fresh water supply is limited, but it plays a key role in Tibet's agricultural and energy industries. Despite China's insistence that the dam activity is meant for hydropower generation, India remains deeply skeptical, adding to tensions between the two countries.
The long-lasting territorial dispute between India and China only complicates matters, with both Asian giants asserting competing claims on the territory in the Eastern Himalayas administered by India. That has caused a deep trust deficit between the two sides on all matters, including shared water resources, and both countries today accuse each other of hydro-hegemonic behavior in the region, with the Brahmaputra being a flashpoint. Due to their geographical location, upstream countries are in a position to manipulate the water flows for their strategic gains.
As the upstream superpower of the region, China does not have any transboundary river policy, but manages the issues bilaterally with downstream countries. It also has not signed a water-sharing treaty with any country. Domestic challenges, including the need for energy security and the global infrastructure development project called the Belt and Road Initiative, mainly drive the country's water diplomacy. Interestingly, many of China's downstream neighbors, including India, have also not signed any such agreement. India has long feared that China intends to use the hydropower dams to assert its control over the Brahmaputra, with many speculating that it will potentially lead to water wars between the two Asian powers. India has repeatedly blamed China for stemming the flow of the Brahmaputra, damaging the ecology and disrupting agricultural production in the country. China has dismissed the criticism. The construction of super hydropower dams on the river is now adding a new dimension to the narrative of water wars between the two sides. Indian media has been aggressively pushing the narrative, while Chinese media has rejected as an absurd theory. Although it is still under construction, its size and the potential impact on river flows have heightened India's fear of water shortage, aggravating geopolitical tensions.
Now, to talk more on this, we are joined by Andrew K.P. Leung from Hong Kong. He's an international and independent China strategist. Now, the already fragile relationship between regional rivals India and China is set to become tenser amid Beijing's plan to build a super hydropower dam on the Brahmaputra River near India and India's counter plan. So how do you see this fresh duel playing out?
The Himalaya represents one of the world's most dynamic and systems because it supplies water to China, India, and also Bangladesh. And then apart from the Brahmaputra, there is the Ganges River, there's the Indus River, and a number of other major rivers flow through from the Himalayas, freshwater systems. Now, these water systems supplied population downstream, numbering some 1.9 billion people in so many different countries. And then these countries rely on this water, not just for drinking, but also for fisheries, for irrigation. So it's hugely important for their economies and the livelihood of the people. Now, of course, China is in the upstream position in the Himalayas. And China, like some other Asian countries, are very water deficit countries, particularly China. China has got the one-fifth of the world's population, but the average water availability in China, the fresh water availability, is only a third of the world average. The world average, of course, includes the most arid regions in the world, including sub-Saharan Africa. And there is not much water up north in China, too much water down south, resulting in major floods. And other countries also rely on water, as I said, not just for drinking, but for agriculture, but also for the cotton, the feeding cotton, feeding the industries.
Mr. Leung, as one of the world's most impoverished regions, each country in South Asia wants to maximize the utilization of the Brahmaputra River, which is known as Yarlung Tsango in China. Why is this river so important for India and China in achieving development goals?
It's important for China because China, as I said, is a water-poor country and relying on fresh water from the Himalayas, not only for the western regions in China bordering the Himalayas, but then the water also flows from the western part of China to other parts of China to the east. So it's a very important water system to China. Likewise, the water flows down India, Bangladesh, at least the Brahmaputra. As I said, there are other river systems like the Ganges, the Indus River, flowing through India and Pakistan as well. And all these countries depend on these freshwater systems, not only for drinking, as I said, but for agriculture, for cotton, for industry, and for their economic survival. And then ecologically, these waters also affect the ecology of the downstream. For example, the Irrawaddy, the river, flows through Myanmar and Laos and various other countries down south. Now, as the water gathers after the monsoon, it's going to create a great deal of water, trapping small fish in the some of the vegetation. And then as the water recedes, the fish is harvested by the local population. So this, again, feeds into the kind of fisheries industries in these countries. And if the water flow is disrupted, either upstream by dam building or because of climate change, it's going to affect the livelihood of billions of people.
Now, Mr. Leung, both South Asian giants accuse each other of hydro-hegemonic behavior, and both have refused to sign a water-sharing or international transboundary water treaty. So the question is, why is this?
Well, this again, geopolitics, rivalry, mistrust, especially between countries like China and India, which have experienced border disputes and also geopolitical rivalry, especially in this time when a lot of the Western countries, especially the United States, which in a way ally with India, is pushing back against China. And then, of course, the questions like Tibet and the border disputes or border crashes exacerbate this conflict. But however, this river system affecting livelihood of so many people is going to be a major powder keg. That's not only affecting India and China, but various other countries downstream. So I think that China and, of course, India and other countries are likely to handle these questions very carefully. And I think the whole thing can only be resolved by further discussions, further negotiations. And there's no point, and it won't help matters if this worsen or accelerate a downward spiral into a war.
Last but not least, India and China have been embroiled in a historical territorial dispute, and now the water dispute only risks more escalation. So what could be its possible repercussions for the region and the world?
As I said, I mean, it's going to exacerbate this kind of disputes in a time of global geopolitics involving the rivalry, confrontation between China and the United States and some of its so-called allies, including India. And of course, there is a global a rivalry and pushback of the United States against China and perceived as its main near-peer challenger for American dominance. So all these are mixed up together, and we are going to have to be facing a very unstable world, I'm afraid, in the coming decades.
Thank you for being on the program. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Shehzad Yunus, an economic analyst, says the already fraught relationship between regional rivals China and India is becoming even more tense over Beijing's plans to build a super hydropower dam in Tibet. A Twitter user, Jari Jamponen, notes that China's dam on the Brahmaputra would be the world's biggest, with capacity of 60 gigawatt, adding that India, too, is considering building a 10 gigawatt dam to counter China's project. Sitan Sibal, a New Delhi-based journalist, cites India's Defense Minister, Rajnath Singh, commenting on latest border clashes between Indian and Chinese forces. He says the matter has been raised diplomatically.
And that was our episode about the British military's agenda in Afghanistan in the name of development and the India-China tensions over the shared water resources. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take great care.
The Limelight.
To Palestinians and their allies, U.S. hypocrisy is palpable. The United States selectively criticizes some countries for their human rights violations, but pointedly ignores the Zionist regime's illegal occupation
of Palestinian territory and its commission of war crimes and crimes against humanity against the Palestinian people. 2 years after launching an investigation of war crimes committed by the Zionist regime in Palestine, the ICC is still dragging its feet because of U.S. pressures. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. Truth Out wrote in this regard, on November 21st, Bezalel Smotrich, head of the Zionist regime's far-right religious Zionism party called Palestinian Human Rights Organizations, an existential threat to Israel. He said that the incoming Israeli regime government must take legal and security measures against them, including seizing their funds. 2 days later, 198 Palestinian regional and international civil society organizations, including the National Lawyers Guild, Center for Constitutional Rights, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and International Association of Democratic Lawyers, wrote an open letter to Chief ICC Prosecutor Karim Khan, decrying missed opportunities for preventive statements in the past year. The CSO cited the Zionist regime's killing of Palestinians without clear provocation, as well as raids and assaults against worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque and at Haram al-Sharif in occupied East Al-Quds. Three of the six designated terrorist organizations, the CSOs noted, have been providing the ICC prosecutor's office with information about serious crimes committed by Israeli nationals within the jurisdiction of the court. The CSOs cited the Apartheid Convention, which lists as an inhuman act of apartheid the persecution of organizations and persons by depriving them of fundamental rights and freedoms because they oppose apartheid. The CSOs wrote that, although Israel's targeting of these organizations could hinder the work of the ICC